Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky. We're going to do things, I guess, a little bit differently today, Andy. Between a lot of news, the Prince news died today. It's Thursday. He died at 57. Really just an awful, awful day for music fans everywhere.
I'm not going to lie, Brian. This has been a really hard one for me.
Right.
Like, I have spent this entire day basically just listening to Prince tracks and like thinking about my whole life, which has basically been as a Prince fan. Like, really, this is a, you know, we'll get into it later. This is a tough one for me.
All right. So it's obviously it's a sad day. We're, you know, both big fans of his music, which we will talk about. The one remnant, though, of the original show script that we are keeping is talking to Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. So on this incredibly sad day, we welcome you, Howard Beck, to the Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast.
The most somber introduction I've ever had, but justifiably so.
Right. We'll try to soothe your pain, America and the world, with Howard Beck.
No pressure, Howard.
Right. So we brought you on. Originally, we had talked last week because we knew you were coming in town for the great Kobe finale, and then, you know, in sticking around for some Clippers playoffs and stuff. So the plan was to talk to you about Kobe, which we will do. But while we have you, your thoughts on Prince?
Yeah, you know, like you guys, I mean, and I might be a little bit older than you guys, but when someone like Prince goes, and obviously way too young regardless, but, I mean, this is on the heels of David Bowie, which was just, what, a month and a half ago or so. I feel like I've lost two absolute icons of my youth in terms of just my own, you know, the music that was like, you know, the soundtrack of my like early years and my teen years, and songs that meant a ton to me. And also, these are two of the most unique and influential musicians of our time. Very, very different, but both just, icons in completely different ways and influenced so many other musicians. And yeah, I just, it was a sucker punch when it was Bowie, and it's like another one today. It's just hard to even get your head around. Prince was my second concert. My first concert ever was the Cars. That was my favorite group in high school, and now I'm dating myself.
That's not bad.
But and then my second concert, both of these, by the way, at the Cow Palace in Daly City in the Bay Area. And I saw Prince there in 1985. Sheila E. opened, and this was the Purple Rain tour. And
wow,
it was just mind blowing. It was so freaking cool.
Yeah, I actually, Howard, and this is one of the only things that, I mean, because we have wonderful parents, Brian and I, and I mean, they've been incredible to us. You could not ask for better parents. But I have like a, I guess now it's a 31-year-old beef with them, because I had tickets to the Purple Rain tour. And they arbitrarily grounded me.
I doubt it.
No, it really was. It really,
in your mind, maybe.
No. They've actually gone on to admit it was arbitrary. The reason they grounded me was, or sort of baited me into behaving in a way that they could justify grounding me. We were leaving town, or they were leaving town, one or the other, the next day early in the morning, and they didn't feel like having to pick me up from the show at like midnight or something. So basically, they baited me into bad behavior that they could justify saying, well, you're grounded. You're not going to this concert.
Wow.
And I've really never forgiven them entirely.
They sort of Joey Crawford him.
They did.
That's really Machiavellian. That's really...
I, I got to be honest with you, Howard, and I know Andy says that this is how – you got to keep in mind, they're old people too. Based on what I know about Andy's behavior as a kid, right around that age especially, I'm willing to bet he did something.
No.
I'm willing to bet.
No, I was on incredible behavior because I wanted to go to this concert. I had been behaving out of my mind like the last few days leading up to that because I really wanted to go. I mean, look, it's maybe the only time in my life – they ever punished me when I didn't deserve it. And quite frankly, I got away with way more than I ever deserved. But this was the one time I actually was unjustifiably punished.
And what did he miss? Because you saw it. So what did he miss?
You know, it's a long time ago, clearly. I remembered, you know, just an incredible energy coming from that stage. I mean, look, my tickets weren't great. You know, I was in high school. It was whatever I could scrap up. I will tell you this, because this is back in the day, you know, Ticketmaster obviously controls everything. And Ticketmaster, there was no internet back in 1985, kids. So to get tickets to a show like Prince or Springsteen, who I also saw during that time frame, you had to go camp out outside of the Warehouse record store or Tower Records or whatever record store you had. In San Jose, for me, it was the Warehouse. I had to go camp out, and we sat there all night, me and my friends. God bless my parents for actually allowing me to do that at age 15 or 16, whatever I was.
I could have used them at the time, Howard.
So that was the deal. You stayed up all night, and then they finally opened the doors in the morning. And, you know, wherever you were in line, you got your tickets. I was still, you know, we weren't floor seats. We were up on the sides somewhere. I remember being to the right of the stage as you're facing the stage. I remember Sheila E.'s set a little bit, and I remember just that with Prince, like it was just the energy. I mean, that was, and as I mentioned, I saw Springsteen during that time. You know, those are two of like the all-time great live performers, guys who just, you know, they and their bands, there's just no let up. And I don't remember how long that show went. I just remember it being this, you know, it was only the second concert of my life. It was just like this mind blowing experience. I do remember there being quite a bit of, you know, obviously just like, you know, pageantry and the lighting and everything on stage. But it's hard to remember. Like, you don't remember set lists. You don't remember, you know, it's been a while. It was, you know, what, 30 something years ago. And damn, I feel old.
I mean, I remember not being allowed to go like it was yesterday.
at least you had a prime, Howard.
Emotional scars take longer to heal.
That's true. They really do.
I'm all right. So yeah, we could wax on Prince for a while, and Andy and I certainly will. But we do. I mean, it's a weird seg to go from, you know, the death of Prince to the end of the Kobe era, because in some ways, one of the things that I keep talking, I had always done on the radio here at 710, when people bring it up, is like they talk about Kobe in terms like he's dying. Like, this is the last time he's ever going to do it's the last this. And he's not dead. He's going to move on to other things. You covered him. What era was the Beck era?
That was 97 to 2004. So his second year in the league, through the loss to the Pistons in the finals.
So you saw some interesting things.
A few.
A couple. When you look back at just the experience of covering him, of what that was, especially during that time, like, again, you know, kind of like the Prince thing. What do you go back to?
Well, you know, the other interesting thing about drawing the parallel, as awkward as that segue could be, I mean, they both are those guys who you look at and you think on some level, these guys are like these incredibly driven genius types, one in music, one in sports, and that when you exist at that level of ability and focus and perfection, or striving for perfection, there's a little kind of a weirdness that comes with it. Like, you know, Kobe's not normal.
No,
Prince was certainly not normal. And Ramona Shelburne, phenomenal piece that she just published a couple days ago. And you can see that, you know, Kobe, he doesn't see the world or think through things the way the rest of us do. And even to the point of, you know, talking about how when he's talking to people, the conversation he's trying to teach you about you, like he's starting to sound like, you know, like kind of the new age healer or something. I mean, it's a little It's a little odd. And I kind of get what he was saying, but so the Kobe that I first meet in 1997 is a much different guy. I mean, I'm sure that essentially he was the same on some level, but you know, the self-image and his public image hadn't built up to legendary status yet. In 1997, his second year in the league, he's still, you know, just the skinny kid who shot all those air balls against Utah. He's still coming off the bench. Nobody knew what he was going to become at that stage. And people would be lying if they said they did. I mean, even Jerry West, you know, as much potential as he saw in him, couldn't have known exactly how things would evolve. And so back then, you know, there was, you know, a little bit more modesty to the way Kobe carried himself. He was younger. He hadn't won any championships yet. He hadn't won any scoring titles or MVPs. And I just found him to be, as I wrote after his final game, I just found him to be a really open, engaging individual. And in fact, was far better to deal with on a day-to-day basis than Shaquille was, because Shaq is moody. Shaq can be the life of the party, or he can be a royal pain in the ass. And he could shut down on us for days at a time, and he could just, you know, mumble his way through interviews just to be difficult intentionally. Kobe wasn't. Kobe was really respectful of the job that we had to do as beat writers. You know, you're there every day when you're covering a team, and, you know, they can get sick of you, and I don't blame them. I got sick of me. but, you know, Kobe at that stage never failed to talk to us at a practice or a game, was always available, was always very friendly, courteous, occasionally a little bit edgy. You know, I'll never forget, you know, moments like, you know, Michael Dickerson was this shooting guard for the Vancouver Grizzlies, who his career was eventually cut short, I think, by a hip injury. But Dickerson was, you know, was a pretty good scorer. And he had dropped, I think, 30 points on Kobe once. And I had the audacity to ask about it the next time they were playing each other. And I just got, like, Kobe just shot me one of those looks and was basically like, I don't play that, or something really dismissive. Like, don't you dare tell me about the guy who scored 30 on me. So he had that edge to him, but he was not this whole Mamba character. He was not, you know, walking around every day like he had to destroy everything in his path or dominate every last minute of every last day. I think there's some aspect of him that you know, kind of got just exaggerated over the years. And it's what I think it's a construct that he thought he had to create and live and breathe just to accomplish what he did. And maybe he's right. Maybe that was the only way for him to do it. But he was much more, you know, and I don't want to say this in a mean way. I just thought he was much more human in those early years, especially from like 97 to 2000, 2001. And then things got a little tense after that because, you know, Vanessa comes along, that starts to cause the strain with his parents. And then a lot of relationships started to fray in the early 2000s there because of a combination of family concerns with Vanessa, the Kobe Shaq stuff, Kobe Phil stuff, and things started to fray. But in the earlier part of his first couple of years, I always remember things like him saying, like, I can't see him. He's behind me somewhere. I'm talking to like Del Harris or Robert Ory or somebody at LA Southwest College, and all of a sudden I hear this voice saying, hey, Howard, you need me today? I turn around, it's Kobe. Like, he's checking in, asking if we need to talk to him before he left practice. Like, you know, people today will probably look at it very cynically, but I think he was just genuinely like he liked the conversation. He enjoyed it and was just being courteous, checking in.
Well, I mean, one of the things, I mean, from covering Kobe, you know, in a different era, but we've covered him for a while as well, that I've always gotten the sense of is that Kobe pays attention to who is trying to ask him questions in earnest and with, you know, actual legitimate intellectual curiosity. You actually care about the answer that you're giving him, as opposed to just looking for a bite or looking for that one sentence that can, you know,
yes,
bridge two paragraphs that are already written and you're just trying to get something done under deadline. And I think he
absolutely
pays attention to that. And if he recognizes you as one of those people, and I'm sure he did recognize you as that way, because
I mean, you're Howard effing Beck, for God's sakes. And you're good at what you do.
You're good at what you do. And you guys have always had, you know, it seemed like at least a reasonably good relationship, or at least for the most part. And I think Kobe keeps, you know, mental notes on stuff like that. For all the reputation he's often had as being surly with media, and I think there was that, you know, especially that period post-Eagle, first couple years without Shaq, he definitely could be pretty salty. But by and large, yeah, I found him to be the same way you're describing him.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that there's some part of it, because Kobe's, like, really, really freaking smart.
Yes, he is.
He could have done anything. If Kobe wasn't a basketball player and he had just decided to be whatever it was, you know, brain surgeon, you know, rocket scientist, whatever, Kobe's really freaking smart, and he's really perceptive about people to almost to a dangerous degree. Like, I think, like, he sees through people, and I think it puts him in a position to be able to kind of manipulate a bit. And in some cases where he, like, this is the whole thing, where he sees weakness in, say, a Smush Parker, he's just going to crush you. So you kind of, you know, on the one hand, yeah, very engaging and personable. And on the other hand, I think, like, the gears are always turning. And you're right that I think that he definitely looked for and appreciated and wanted the more interesting questions, the more probing questions. The first time I ever asked him, I think it was the first time I asked him for a sit down, you know, a one-on-one, back in those early couple of years. And I said, hey, could I get you, you know, maybe if you shoot around or something, you know, 15, 20 minutes, whatever. And he said, yeah, I think that's fine, but do me a favor. Can you, you know, as long as it's not just the same old stuff. Like, he literally went out of his way to say, like, this is a time when every freaking story about Kobe was about, is he the next Jordan? What, you know, how are all the ways that Kobe Bryant is like Jordan? You know, he talks like Jordan. He's trying to pattern his game. Like, he was so sick of that narrative. And, you know, later in his career, he embraces the Jordan comparison more once he's comfortable with himself. But early on, you can imagine, you know, that you're, you know, you want to be your own person. And the comparisons were driving him crazy. Not that he couldn't live up to it, or that he felt pressure by it. It was just annoying after a while. And so his request to me when I asked for the sit-down was, let's, you know, just bring something new to the table. I don't remember what that new thing was, but I came up with something.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because, like, you mentioned it with, like, the personality and the creation of this sort of the mythology, which gets incredibly heavy post-Colorado. But it seemed like early in his career, too, that, you know, and this is something that Ramona talks about and other people have addressed, there was that searching for what he was. And maybe that's what eventually leads him to this kind of persona. But, you know, he didn't, you know, his background is really well documented and sort of not fitting into any one particular world. Did you get a sense from him even then that some of this, you know, he was sort of finding his way as a person in the world at the same time as he was in this incredibly harsh public spotlight, and what that did, sort of how he interacted with you, how he interacted with the game and all that other stuff?
No, that is a really, really perceptive premise and question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it goes to some things that I kind of meant to write about in that column a week ago after his final game, and I just couldn't squeeze it all in. So, first of all, yeah, he comes into the league. He's 17 when he's drafted, 18 when he debuts. Everybody, of course, changes, evolves. You know, if you've done any reflection whatsoever, if you are capable of any of evolution, the guy you are at 18 and the guy you are at 25 and then 30 and then 35 should be different. And Kobe, like a lot of guys in this position, pro athletes, celebrities, we judge them and then we pigeonhole them. This is who they are. And then we don't allow them to evolve. And I bring that up because, yeah, Kobe on day one, and I'm not judging piercings and tattoos, I don't care, but I'm just saying, no piercings, no tattoos, no entourage. There was nothing artificial about him. There was nothing that was trying to be showy or to play any kind of role or play up some kind of image. He just was who he was. And some of those things did come later, tattoos and piercings here and all that stuff.
And entourage.
and the entourage. But when he was early on, even as he became a star, and he's an all-star in his third season, second season, even then there wasn't any of this artifice or any of this big public image. So when he started doing other things, when he did get his ear pierced, when he made that horrible rap album, and then we would go to him and say, hey, Kobe, you pierced your ear. And he would get really indignant and irritated that we were even asking about it. And I don't blame him. Like anybody, again, in that stage of your life, you're trying new things. You're trying even on new identities or trying out different aspects of your personality. You're growing. Like that's what it means to be, you know, a person coming into adulthood, you know, from 18 to 22 or something. So, there are times you look back and you think, man, we just don't give these guys space to grow and evolve. And so there was that aspect of it. But there's something else you mentioned in the question, which was about Kobe finding himself and all that. There's been plenty of discussion about, you know, yeah, growing up in Italy and, you know, how that, you know, shaped him and not fitting in. Remember the early 2000s, everything was all about street cred. We never hear that phrase anymore, street cred. Iverson was Mr. Street Cred. Iverson was, you know, the hard scrabble, you know, kid from Washington, or, you know, you've gone to Georgetown and gotten in a big fight at a bowling alley and gone to jail and had cornrows and, you know, had this more brusque demeanor and whatever. So everybody fell in love with Iverson. Kobe was by far, to me, from the get-go, the better player. And I'll never forget Slam Magazine years later, I think on the 10-year anniversary of that draft, still put Iverson number one in the draft ahead of Kobe. And I thought, you're crazy. But everyone fell in love with Iverson because they fell in love with the image of Iverson and this whole street cred thing. He was real. He had cred. And Kobe was not real. And that bothered Kobe. Here's Iverson playing for his hometown-ish team in Philadelphia. And Kobe is looked at as being kind of too straight-laced. And so I bring that up because, again, he came in kind of like that, and people embraced that. It was like with Durant. Remember Durant? Everybody loved the fact that Durant was like the clean-cut, nice kid, and he became like the anti-LeBron for a while because LeBron became the villain. Well, that was kind of Kobe and Iverson in a different way. And I've mentioned this to several people in the last week as I've kind of tried to reflect back on all these moments, but Kobe never even cursed in front of us. Not like even like the S word. Like, he never cursed in front of us. And then one day, third, fourth, fifth year in, somewhere in there, he walks through the locker room, headphones on, he's listening to hip hop, and he's singing the lyrics, and it's all of a sudden like, you know, F this, F that, da, 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 whatever. Like, and he like just walked right past us, like reciting these lyrics. I'm going, what the fuck was that? I never heard Kobe curse in front of us. And all of a sudden, here it was. But again, this is, you know, a young guy in his early 20s, kind of, you know, grown into who he is. And so at a certain point, he kind of dropped all the, you know, nice guy, you know. He probably got sick of the well-spoken kid who could speak Italian and, you know, went to the suburban nice high school and
sort of fitting this great image, this great clean cut image that, you know, the guy, the kid in the Sprite commercials and all these other things that we all love. I mean, that's the fun thing that people forget is like, for, you know, because it's all hero villain now, it's all Kobe and the mythology of being hated everywhere he goes and all that, which really stopped half a decade ago, you know, at least. And so, but people forget that Kobe was the golden boy.
Yeah,
in the beginning, when he first came in, there was way more pressure on Shaq in the beginning, and Shaq was considered, you know, more divisive. He had far more critics. But what's interesting, though, too, Howard, in the way you're talking about that early time with Kobe, and this is something that Ramona Shelburne's article for ESPN the magazine gets into extremely well. Now, you know, Kobe, there was that period where Kobe and Vanessa, you know, during Eagle, she had kicked him out of the house, and he went off by himself, basically with just like some clothes and his motorcycle. And he kind of invented the Mamba persona for himself. And he says, like, you know, things changed from there. And you look at right now, and Ramona's piece really reflects this, Kobe's become this guy who, like, now 97% of what he ever says or does is an exercise in branding.
And mythology,
really,
and
I mean, and really, that, I mean, yeah. He is, and I don't mean this as a criticism of him. It's just fact. I mean, he's become, I think, even by his own admission, incapable of thinking in any other terms. I mean, everything he does in some way feeds the mythology of Kobe, and he's brilliant at it.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what's led to some of this, you know, cynicism about, oh, well, he's trying to buff up his image now in this final year before he rides off into the sunset. He wants everybody to look at him as being a nice guy now, but we know better because we've seen the a-hole version of him for the last several years, so this can't be the real version. To which I, of course, responded, no, wait, the guy I met way back when was much closer to this version that you're seeing this season and not the extreme a-hole version. And it's not that he couldn't be the extreme a-hole. He had those moments too, but, you know, I thought those were usually in moments of, you know, duress or, you know, things going on in his life. It wasn't it wasn't his day-to-day mode. It wasn't his default personality. But he really played up that image. And, you know, if that began with – and you look, I think we all could have surmised that a lot of that dark imagery and the edginess and everything emerged from what happened in Colorado and what happened in his marriage and everything else. It was interesting to see him finally talk about it and put all those pieces together and say, yeah, that's how we got here. But I still believe that a lot of that was, whether it's defense mechanism, whether it's also what he had to do in a post-Shaq era to feel like this is the leader I need to be, this is who I have to be now that I have all the burden on my shoulders. You know, right or wrong, I think that's what he chose. That was the personality and the approach that he chose. And I like that he's kind of gone back to being who I think he really is. Now, the fact that everything is now with the thought process of like his brand and everything, yeah, it makes you wonder a little bit. But having known him in the earlier years and then I think known a little bit or gotten at least a little insight into who I thought he was before all of this, I still think that what we're seeing now is closer to the real Kobe than all that other
stuff. I think he spent the last two or three years telling us the truth. When you ask him a question, he tells you the truth. I mean, it's calculated. He's, like you said, he's smart. He knows what he's saying, but he's not BSing you. He's not creating things. It's just his truth now, I think, gets constructed in the context of this person in some degree that he created for himself. But what you touched on this before, and I think it's something not just with Kobe, but with all of these guys, particularly in basketball, because it is impossible for these guys to hide. Maybe Marcelo Huertas can maybe walk down the street without being bothered, although, you know, probably not by the end of the year. It's impossible for these guys not to be a little bit weird. I think, you know, Kobe is
the
person.
Most underreported part of Kobe's career is that he's a weirdo.
He's just an odd guy.
He's a weird dude.
He's kind of a nerd. He's obviously, you know, from a social standpoint, awkward because he's devoted, in part because he's devoted so much of his life to basketball and this focus, which he'll tell you is destructive to relationships and all that. But we're talking about somebody who, you know, every, three, four times a year meets Make-A-Wish kids, like dying children. He is their final wish. When he goes to China, people weep, like they walk up to him and begin weeping before they even can speak, if they can speak at all. And I don't see how you can live in that world. We all want our stars to be magnanimous and these wonderful people and just like us. How? It's impossible. You can't be.
It would be hard for Kobe to not consider himself an oracle of some kind. I mean, really, when you are treated this way for so long, and you know this, Howard, Kobe has a fandom that I've never seen in another athlete when it comes to just sheer zealous devotion from your fans. Yeah. I've never seen it before with another athlete.
Yeah, people call them Kobe stans now. I always call them the Kobeites.
Yep. I call them the Kobe zealots.
We've done both.
Yeah, like the Kobeites. Like they just and they weren't necessarily even Laker fans. They were just Kobe fans.
Oh, so, there's a difference.
There is a difference. Yeah, and they kind of scare me, frankly.
they should.
Yeah, because you could say no wrong about him. There wasn't a single criticism or even observation that sounded, you know, if it sounded even remotely critical to these folks, they just wouldn't accept it. It is weird. It is a strange, like, religious devotion. And, yeah, I guess if you're him and you feel that and you see that, I guess it kind of has to affect you. It might be hard to stay normal amid that.
I think the guy's life is so – From the time he was born, really, almost between his sort of intensity and focus on being the greatest basketball player who ever lived, and then the explosion of his fame and the fact that he can't live a life that is normal by any remote stretch. I just think I feel like we overlook that. When I'm not saying you necessarily like let all the devotion go to his head and all this and that, whatever, like you say, it could be hard to avoid. I just think generally when we look at athletes, particularly athletes that are as big as Kobe, we ignore that part of the way these guys live day in and day out.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, look, Michael Jordan's not normal. You know, Michael Jordan's a crazy person too. I mean, he's the greatest. He's awesome. But Jordan could be really cruel to teammates and friends, and you know, even the Hall of Fame speech where he tells his kids, "I wouldn't want to be you." And he didn't say it in a way where it was sounded sympathetic. It just sounded like, "You guys are screwed. You can't possibly live up to what I've done."
He sounded like he relished the idea that they were screwed.
He's defeated everyone, including his children.
Yeah, it's just guys at that level, you lose a little of your humanity. You get a little bit too detached, and your empathy wanes. Now, that said, Kobe's empathy, of course, is off the charts when it comes to, as you mentioned, the Make-A-Wish Foundation kids and a lot of the other great work that he's done. And I know, that they've done a lot of work with the homeless. And so it's not that there's no generalized empathy, but sometimes it's that one-to-one relationships, or sometimes just the ability to relate to everyday people. You're living in a bubble. And, yeah, I guess it kind of has to affect you on some level. And to the extent that you, as you mentioned, like people kind of like, crying when they see him or being in tears when they see him. And then this worship, this idolatry kind of thing, when he says in Ramona's story, and I'm going to botch the quote, but that part where it was about basically like, when you're there, people are talking to him and he's telling them about themselves, or he's helping them understand
right.
who they are, not who he is. That sounds really pretentious and strange. But if you think about the way people kind of, have elevated him into this deity, then it does almost make sense. He's gotten maybe a little caught up in that.
Well, the quote is, "I don't do things for people to understand me. I say things to help them understand themselves." And what to me is really fascinating about that is, on one hand, I think it could be something Kobe sincerely believes, because he is a smart guy and he does understand.
Yeah, Howard said, like people come to him and
right.
say, "Tell me,
right.
tell me something."
He's got a voice. I mean, in some way, they go to him almost like Don Corleone, not just for favors but for advice. But on the other hand, I don't doubt for a second that Kobe is aware of the branding effect with this, and that he is aware of the mythology building by saying this, and it's not an accident. And what's interesting is both can be 100% true.
Yeah. And then look, should people be seeking truth from Kobe any less than seeking truth from Dr. Phil or Oprah or whoever? I mean, he's as qualified as anybody. No, I'm serious.
I agree.
No,
I completely
I'm laughing.
Agree with you.
I never thought about
I'd
that.
I'd rather take my advice from Kobe than Dr. Phil.
It beats the hell out of people wanting to know what Kim Kardashian thinks about anything. But also there's this. Kobe has achieved great things within his realm of athletics, of sports, of basketball. And he's done it with, as we all know, this incredible drive and focus and commitment. And to the extent that I've been around the NBA now for 19 years and I've seen him up close and Phil Jackson up close and, interactions here and there with guys like LeBron or whatever, I look at them and I'm constantly trying to internalize some of what I'm seeing. I am. Like, if you don't try to learn at least a little bit from the people who are the greatest in their field, and this, by the way, includes other writers in the room, too, who I'm looking at and thinking, how is Lee Jenkins doing what he does,
It's disgusting.
That's for all of us. You're always looking for the examples, role models, in essence, and how they do things. And to the extent that athletes are role models, and Kobe has, presented a good model on the court, for how to be the best at what you do. Now, it went off to an extreme that maybe is not healthy, but how could I not be around him and not think, man, I should work a little harder, as Kobe's busting his ass every day. Look at how great it's made him. Or being around Phil and listening to Phil talk about being in the moment. And now we hear Kobe say that all the time, and he parrots it. I found myself, again, those 5 years of covering him day to day. How can you not internalize some of the Zen and some of the other things that he introduced, because it was like, oh, that makes sense. I need to take a freaking breath now
right.
and then.
And you're talking about one of his most admirable qualities, particularly as it relates to what he's going to do now with Kobe Inc. and going forward and all these other things. Kobe's been doing that. He's been doing that process that you're talking about, looking at the other people in the room and saying, they're the greatest at what they do. What can I learn from them? He's been doing that for years now. I mean, I asked him during one of the press conferences that he had this year, when did that process begin for you? And he told a story about calling up Louis Vuitton when he was like 23, just to learn stuff. And, you know, Andy and I always make the joke that, you know, Kobe will say, I cold called Tim Cook, right? Cold called Oprah. I mean, no, you didn't. You're Kobe Bryant. You called them. You know, we cold call people. You just call people and all that. But the point is he's calling. And like, whereas I think the biggest thing that separates Jordan from Kobe is intellectual curiosity. Jordan has very little of it. And Kobe is filled with it. And and it's genuine and it's real and it's incredibly admirable, because it would be so easy for Kobe to be look at. I can just say, I've done everything I've, you know, I can take the same strategies and things that got me where I am in basketball and apply that to everything. There's nothing anybody else can teach me because I'm obviously this good at stuff. And he does not do that.
Not only that, but it explains why, and this is, again, not a major leap, it explains why he had such low tolerance for Shaq and for some other teammates that he had over the years. Because he's looking around and going, why aren't you guys as curious and as striving as I am? Why aren't you working as hard as I am? Why aren't you – like, he's wired a certain way, and he just can't understand how anybody else does it differently or doesn't do it at the same level. And – you know, it's an asset and it's a detriment.
Well, looking forward, because as it's been well covered in this podcast, and really I'd say the entire news cycle for the last couple of weeks, Kobe's retired.
What?
He's not going to play anymore. Where do you think the franchise goes from here?
It's really tough to see, right? I mean, you look at it and you think, we've all, you know, in all of our lifetimes, you know, it seems like they've just always been great. And it's funny because when I came to the beat in 97 and when they finally won the championship in 2000, it was like, oh, it had been 12 long years since the last championship of the Showtime era in 88. Well, first of all, this stage of life now, I don't think of 12 years as being that long anymore because I'm getting old. But also, like, their lean years, the non-Showtime years, the, you know, Nick Van Exel, Cedric Ceballos years, whatever, wasn't really that long a period of time. And they were actually still pretty competitive, at least. Then they had good players, you know, compelling players.
But these are lean years.
These are legit.
These are legitimately lean.
You want
years.
Lean? We got your lean.
This is spam, yeah. Man.
Yeah. This is something else entirely. And so, they've never been through anything like this. Clearly, we the public have never seen it like this. And I think that because we're in a different era, you can't expect it's just going to write itself automatically either. And look, Jerry West had to move heaven and earth in the summer of 96 to get Shaq and Kobe together in the first place. And he already had a decent team. But they don't even have that, you know. And I don't know how they move forward because free agency is not a panacea. Everybody's going to have cap money this summer. Being in L.A. isn't enough necessarily because players more than ever are really conscious of ownership and front offices and the team they're joining and whether they trust that franchise and whether they think they're going to go join other players who can make them look good. You know, we saw it last summer with Greg Monroe and LaMarcus Aldridge and the decisions they made. I just don't know that the Laker mystique is a thing anymore. I don't know if it's strong enough. It's not that it's gone. Those banners will be there forever. But does it mean that people will just automatically believe just because you told them, hey, we're the Lakers, we'll be great, don't worry about it, just, you know, come sign a contract? And they just have a lot of work to do. I mean, that's just the basic fundamentals of it. They don't have a single guy that you can say you could build around. Maybe Russell becomes that guy. I don't know. I don't think Randall's that guy. But, again, we've seen 1 year. And, you know, right, it takes time for guys to grow into who they're going to be. So I think the worst thing, to be honest, is that they seem to have allowed themselves to stall out in terms of what they think their direction or their vision is.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, everybody in this city, I'm still in L.A. right now, so everybody here that I've encountered in the last week and a half seems convinced that sometime soon, probably this time next year, Byron will be gone, Jim Buss will be gone, and Mitch Kupchak will be gone. And if everybody's convinced that that's actually going to happen, why isn't it just happening right now? And I'm not advocating for anybody to be fired. I don't do that. I'm just saying if you've stalled out and you believe you've got nowhere left to go and you need new direction, new leadership and everything, I don't get why they're just...
Well, I mean, what else, though, Howard, have they been doing the last few years other than kicking whatever can down the road?
They've been propping up Kobe as the wizard, you know, so the great and all-powerful wizard, so nobody looks behind the curtain.
And I don't fault them even for that part of it, guys, because look at what Kobe has done from the last couple of years. I mean, granted, it's been hard for him to stay on the court, but, you know, the publicity, the good feelings that he generates, obviously the money that he generates, these things weren't mutually exclusive. You could try to plan a little better for your present and future and still sign him to the deal you didn't have him around.
Yes, we've been screaming about this the last few years, Howard. The idea of
they're not a walk and chew gum kind of group.
No, I mean, the idea that, like, well, it's really impossible to balance developing the kids while showcasing Kobe. No, it's not. You just have to be adults in the room and come up with an actual plan and hold everybody to it. It's actually not that hard at all.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that if you don't have a coach who can do that, then you need a different coach. And if you have a front office that doesn't think it can be done, well, then maybe you need a different front office. But I just, I'm not a Laker fan, so it has no impact on me, right? I'm not emotionally invested. But having seen this franchise up close for the 7 years that I was a beat writer, having been around the NBA for the time that I have, I look at it and it's kind of just frustrating to see, because I think, my gosh, how can you let yourself just slip this far? This thing's to erode at
this
point. And yeah, okay, look, now Kobe is retired. So if you thought that he was an impediment, he's gone. That's no longer an excuse. That's no longer a security blanket. What are you doing now? And right now they're doing nothing. They're standing in place, and you know, Tom Thibodeau's taking the job in Minnesota, and I'm not saying that he was going to be the key to the turnaround necessarily, but there are opportunities that are potentially being missed. And again, if you don't think that your front office is capable of bringing in the next franchise player and building this thing back up again, what are you waiting for?
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, all of which we'll talk about over the course of the year. My last question for you, I have a theory that, and I think this may even apply to Jordan in Chicago, that no single star, based because of the level of success that Kobe had, because of the length of time that he was here, 20 years, which is unprecedented really anywhere, but certainly in the NBA, and you know, the unique nature of his personality, that Kobe has transformed the fan base in L.A., in ways that I don't think any other star has, even Jordan in Chicago, just because, you know, he wasn't there quite as long. And social media, all these, it was a different universe. What happens to the guy who comes next? Like, what's life in you? What do you think life is going to be like for the guy who comes next to, quote unquote, take the proverbial torch?
Wow. That's a really interesting question. I mean, it's, you know, guys avoided Jordan's shadow forever. I mean, the Bulls couldn't get anybody to come there. Part of that, too, was that people didn't trust their front office, which may be another parallel. Different, but still. But the idea that you know, you're going to try to bring somebody in and say, you're our next franchise star, and yeah, you're coming in the wake of Kobe, and also just that entire string of guys, you know, Kobe and Shaq and Magic and Kareem. I mean, I just think it's a tough place to be, period, if you're put on that pedestal, and if those hopes are now, you know, you're the embodiment of all these hopes, and that you're supposed to put up the next banner. You know, there are guys who will be willing to do that. You know, I think, you know, if Kevin Durant were to leave Oklahoma City, that's not going to put him off. He's not worried about that.
Well, I see. I disagree. I think it would bug him. I think the constant Kobe comparisons would really bug him. I don't think it would bother Westbrook, but I think it would bother Durant.
They're different, and I think Durant is a little more sensitive, and certainly we've seen that. We've seen he could be pretty thin-skinned, in fact. But he's also already established himself as an MVP and a scoring champion multiple times. He's been to the finals. If it were Durant at age 19, 20, 21, or Durant's pre-playoff success, I think he would chafe a lot more at comparisons. Because of what he's already accomplished, I think there's at least enough self-assurance there that I think he could take it. But you're right to say that it's not a given, and that it will get annoying for anyone, Durant, Westbrook, whoever else may, you know, come along in the next few years, who they'll chase. I don't think anybody would relish that. That's
right,
for sure. And especially because it's not just Kobe's success. It's not just the five titles and the MVP and everything and the 81-point game. It's also just, you know, what we've been talking about. It's the fact that people worship at the altar of Kobe in a way that is far beyond almost anyone we've seen, certainly in L.A. And to have that as the barometer, as the, you know, the standard, I think I wouldn't envy anybody who walks into that.
All right. Well,
I'm sure it's not lost on those dudes.
No,
either.
Absolutely not. He is the great Howard Beck, formerly of the L.A. Times, then the New York Times. He did all the Timeses, the L.A. Daily News.
L.A. Daily News. Yeah.
Right. You never did the Times, did you? You just went for you did.
No, I wasn't good enough for the other
right.
Times.
So you went through the Daily News, then the New York Times, and then now at Bleacher Report. And I know we said when we were texting earlier that we'd keep you like 20, 25 minutes, but we used our incredibly engaging questions and Jedi mind powers to keep you much longer than that, so we appreciate it.
What up, Beck?
those were impressive Jedi mind powers.
But yeah, you didn't even know. It's like, where'd the time go?
Well, I've also just been walking around Hermosa, so, you know, that you kind of lose all track of time here.
That's true.
And so, you know, perfectly pleasant. But thanks, guys. That was a fantastic conversation.
Really. Say hi to Bresnahan for us.
Right.
If you're wandering around the South.
And all of the L.A. Kings.
And all of them. Yeah. I have seen a bunch of, like, Go Kings signs around here. I have not seen any Go Clippers signs. Which is
no. All right. Well,
well it should be.
He is Howard Beck, and you can read all of his stuff over there at Bleacher Report, and you should. Thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Howard Beck. Thanks again to him. He's really good at
yes,
what he does.
He's quite good.
Very, very good at it. And
by the way, too,
one of the many good people that they have at Bleacher Report.
I just brought
Jonathan Abrams
on. They just brought him on. Jonathan Abrams, fantastic writer, really good dude, too. He's also going to be doing, and this is something we will be sure to have him on as a guest when it happens, an oral history of The Wire. You want to talk
He's going to be on Whitlock's podcast, Fox, for like a month. He's just going to be like an artist in residence at that. Just saying. I don't know. I mean, we don't always talk about people on other networks. I'm just saying.
He says yes.
That's true. So it is weird to me, and I posted this the other day, and we'll get into the print stuff here in just a second. It's weird to me. And even a week later, it's still a little weird to refer to Kobe's career in the past tense.
Yeah.
You know, and that story that Mitch told at exit interviews where it's like he's – because they've had the names up of the roster and, you know, you erase people all the time or whatever. And, you know, he couldn't get Kobe's name off. It had been there so long. Basically, the marker died or dried. And it's like, you know, it was crusted on there. And he took an incredible amount of elbow grease to get the name off his board. But as he said, the name is off the board. Like – it's time to move on.
What happened is Byron told him, man up.
Right.
And then Mitch really started scrubbing hard. And then finally the ink
called him soft. He's like, you know, back in my day, which, by the way, coincidentally was also your day, we could have gotten that off. Pat Riley would have run us until we got that thing off the board. But, you know, like little stuff. Like you go into the locker room and Kobe's locker, the nameplate that says Bryant, was a font that nobody else had anymore because it had been there for 20 years or 18, I guess, when they moved into that.
Even just being the guy who takes Kobe's locker. I mean, like little things that the general public.
Do you think they'll put somebody in his locker next
year? Yeah.
They have open lockers in that room. Next to Kobe's, for example,
I guess what they could do is give somebody else Kobe's open locker. And then, like, maybe a star guy gets, you know, Kobe's open locker as his locker and then Kobe's regular locker as the extra locker.
Right. But I don't know if they'll fill it next year. I mean, it's one thing. Sure, somebody will wear 24 next year. Can you imagine the balls? Like, if the guy who comes in and says, I will sign with you or I will play with you, but I have to wear 24.
I remember years ago when we were still working for the LA Times, I wrote a piece when Kobe Carl was looking to make the team. I wrote a piece because you remember at the time he heard every single, you know, Kobe. Oh, no, not that Kobe. You know, not that right. Kobe. This Kobe joke. I wrote a piece about how, because this is after Kobe had switched from 28 to 24. That Kobe Carl should take 8. Like that would have been phenomenal if Kobe Carl had taken 8.
It would have been the most, at the same time, the most dangerous and boss move like a guy could do.
But what he should have done, though, like I said, is not only take 8, but when people are like, dude, he'd be like, why? What's the significance?
Just pretend you have no idea.
Kobe wore that? Really? Well, he's not wearing it anymore.
I've always been a KG guy.
Yeah.
And I've never really watched.
Well,
My
number now.
It is. I have to say, I've grown. I'm not Kobe's friend. I don't have a great relationship with him in the sense of, like, I know a lot of – I don't know him personally. I mean, I don't think most people know him personally. But even by media
– anybody knows him personally.
Even by media, I still say the most jaw-dropping moment I've had covering sports, not just covering the Lakers, covering sports, is when Derek Fisher said he'd never been to Kobe's house.
Yeah.
And I was not the only person who was like, really? Because they were besties. And the first guy, really, I think, who actually went to Kobe's house, ironically, I think was Dwight.
Yeah.
After the Achilles.
And they Dwight,
the photo.
And, Jody
Dwight
Meeks.
And Jody Meeks at a photo op at Kobe's house after he tore his Achilles.
Probably weird. It probably explains, though, why Kobe insisted that Jody walk in first,
right,
and Dwight walk in 10 minutes later.
Yeah, probably.
That is, by the way, not factually accurate.
No, I don't think so. It would have been weird. Nope.
He made Dwight stay outside.
Time not up yet.
Jody and Kobe like FaceTimed Dwight as Dwight's outside in the
car. Dwight was actually putting that photo in post. But it's, you know, I have developed more sympathy. I'm like, I think we have always had a good working relationship,
yeah,
with Kobe for what we do. There have been a few moments where I think we've asked for a couple one-on-ones over the course of time, and not too many.
No.
But certainly times when we pull him aside, hey, can I ask you?
Always been helpful.
5 minutes, and he's always done it. And I think he doesn't think we're morons, which, by the way, puts him at odds with most other people. I'm more sympathetic to him in the same way that I'm sympathetic to other athletes, just because again, particularly basketball players, because they can't go anywhere and blend in. I don't think we appreciate how weird it is to be these people, to be recognized everywhere you go. To even if they don't know who you are, you're 6'7", 6'8", 6'10", 6'11". You know, I was talking to I think it was Richard Jefferson. It was like he went to the bank and the teller didn't know who he was, but it's like, do you play basketball? And he's on the one hand, Richard Jefferson is a really bright guy. And he's like, you know, on the one hand, I get it. She's just being nice. But it's like, could I not do anything else? You know, I imagine too, particularly as like a 6'8" black guy, he's like, is that the only thing I could possibly do is play basketball? And, you know, Kobe can't go anywhere. You are always surrounded by people who you have to question whether or not they want a piece of something from you or whatever it might be. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic to him, and I will certainly miss not being able to talk to the guy.
Oh, yeah.
He
was a really, yeah, really interesting guy to speak with.
All right. Turning now to get back to Prince. This is a really sad day.
Yes, it is. Yes, I mean, this has been, you know, the news of Prince's death broke this morning Pacific time where we are in L.A. And I have to say, I mean, it's been several hours since, Brian, and I've been in like a daze. I mean, like, really, I've been like texting with friends of mine, you know, especially friends from high school and stuff like that, you know, and it seemed like a lot of people who follow us on Twitter or, you know, are generally familiar with our work know that we are both, you know, especially me, like really big Prince fans. And I have been like a lifelong Prince fan. The first album, Brian, that I remember buying like on my own, like going out and seeking on my own, was in 1981, riding my bike to Streetside Records and buying Controversy. You know, I mean, I was like 9 years old. I really didn't understand the album.
I hope not.
But I was, I've been
very lax parenting by mom and dad.
And, you know, I knew some of his work. But at that point forward, I was just hooked. And I have been listening to Prince longer and with more enthusiasm than any musician or band in my life.
Yeah. And I forget exactly how old David Bowie was, and we could look it up, you know, while I'm talking. When he died, and I know Howard mentioned this, but like when he died, it was like, on the one hand, it was surprising because nobody knew he was sick. Yeah, it turned out he was very ill, but nobody knew. And you don't think of him as necessarily an old man. He was born in 1947.
He was 69
years old. You thought of him as a guy almost from another era. He was from that 60s era, from the 70s. And when people like that go, you know what? We're starting to get to a point where people like of that age can die. And it was really sad and all that. But, you know, 70 years old, okay. Prince was 57, and obviously that kind of thing can happen to anybody. But there was a timelessness to Prince,
yeah,
and an agelessness to Prince. Because in part, like you look at him, he looks almost exactly the same today as he did in 1982. If you go back and look at concert footage, and I don't know exactly what his preservation regimen was, but whatever it was very good.
It's, as is my understanding, as the joke goes, a lot of clean living.
Yeah.
Like, Prince was never, I mean, I don't want to say never, but certainly for the latter part of his years, it was my understanding he took pretty good care of himself.
Yeah, but there's just, because of that, there was like, he's a little guy and he always sort of, he was so incredibly dynamic still as a performer. It's weird, not just because he's younger, and he's certainly 57 is sort of, you know, too young, as they say, to go. But you almost picture, it's like, I would have assumed Prince would outlive me.
Yeah. Well, I was saying to my wife.
He's 17 years older than
I was saying to my wife, because, you know, she knows how big a Prince fan I am. And, you know, like, I actually, you know, some will talk about, like, in my 5-year-old daughter is a huge Prince fan.
Right.
From hearing Prince in the car with me. And, you know, I didn't even try to point out that the music was playing. She actually gravitated towards one of his songs. It's an obscure one called La 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 He 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 that she liked because there are these dogs barking in the background. She called it the puppy song and thought it was funny. But then she started listening to other songs and like really liking his songs. And she hears all this. So, you know,
I don't know why you let her listen to Darling Nikki. But, I mean, it's a good song, but
you get carried away.
I thought it was irresponsible.
You get carried away. No, there are actually quite a few songs.
Darling Nikki, by the way, is the song that is why we now have labels on albums.
Yep. Thank you, Tipper Gore. The PMRC, which is something I think would, by the way, would be a fascinating documentary that we should do. But my wife texted me. She's like, you know, I'm sorry. You know, she knew I was really bummed by this. And I was like, you know, I know people die. I just always sort of figured Prince was above something like that.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you know, death is too mundane for someone like Prince.
And it's funny because, like, you don't – like, I'm not going to lie. It's not like I've been – I mean, the guy still produced a ton of stuff. But I stopped looking for new Prince music a while ago. I went back today and listened to one of his albums from, like, 2014. And it's not like my favorite Prince album. It's still pretty damn good. It's like pretty funky. It's got, you know, the guy is still putting out good stuff. He's one of those people that the world, you feel like the world is a better place, a more creative place, a more energetic place. The opportunity to go see that, it makes me happy. And I saw him in concert when he came to the Forum. I know you did too. And it was an amazing show. But like, you like living in a world where people can go see Prince. In the same way, I'm not even a Springsteen fan. But I like the joy that Springsteen concerts bring Springsteen fans.
Yeah, and I mean,
Prince is like that.
I've been thinking about this today. I've never met anybody who doesn't like Prince. Like, I mean,
no.
You're right. I mean, like, I know some people who are bigger fans than others, or some are like, yeah, you know, he's fine. I don't have any of his music, but I've never met anyone who's like, I hate Prince.
Yeah, and this is something we have so much stuff that we could talk about. This is one thing that I think is. That is coming out today that never got enough play when he was alive. This is a thing from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think in 2012. And it's guys doing My Guitar Gently Weeps, which is the Beatles song George Harrison wrote. It's like Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne, I think, and so a bunch of, I mean, really high-end musicians on the stage performing a great cover of this song. And all of a sudden, like, literally out of the shadows, like, Prince just appears, and he doesn't sing. He's not like the front guy.
He just
comes in, and all of a sudden starts playing the guitar
and blows
and just destroys it.
And
it's coming up here. And, like, this part's good. And he's like, you know, you will watch it on YouTube. It's good, but it starts, it builds. And what's amazing about it, it's like, the most underrated thing about Prince was that he was a balls out amazing guitar player.
I think during his prime, I think actually, you know, as Prince's prime, or what people consider the prime, you know, the 80s, where he was really flat out untouchable, I think that period he was more underrated as a guitar player. I think as time has passed, people have really given him that due, and they
some maybe.
I think so.
I don't know.
I really do, and the reason is because he's become more prolific as somebody touring. And when you tour, you
see
him playing.
That's true.
But I know the point you were going to make, Brian, is during his prime, the videos and a lot of what he was doing, you knew he was this amazing musician and songwriter, especially performer. But I don't think people gave him enough credit. You're right. As a guitar, growing up, other than Frank Zappa, who was an unbelievable guitar player, I used to think Prince was the most underrated guitar player in rock.
Yeah, but like you... I think there are a lot of people still walking around the earth and, you know, again, maybe they're ignorant or whatever, but that don't realize Prince was the guy playing the guitar on Let's Go Crazy. You know, like that was actually Prince playing the guitar. And I think some of it is in a lot of videos and, you know, you go back and I was loading stuff on our board for today and all that. Like a lot of times it's because he's not actually playing guitar.
Well,
in
I will
videos.
Say this. If you didn't pick
he's
up,
like shimmying and doing stuff.
If you did not pick up on it from the Let's Go Crazy video, you're just not paying hard enough attention.
Right.
But he's actually playing the guitar.
Right. If you didn't, he plays the guitar all through Purple Rain. I mean, it's there, but I think he was such. He was doing so many other things.
Well, he had the multi-instrumentalist
reputation. Right, he was doing that, and he was writing the songs, and he was dancing, and, you know, he was, you know, surrounding himself with three or four or five, you know, bisexual women at a time. And, you know, there were a lot of things to look at that weren't necessarily Prince playing the
guitar. Shout out
to
Wendy and Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Who are, by the way, too, in their own right, quite talented.
Trying to figure out how I can describe Prince's entourage.
Well, you know what's funny, too, their relationship was kept a secret for a long time. Like, I don't think they're together anymore, Wendy and Lisa, but they were together for like 20 years, and they really kept it very, very quiet.
I think it's probably sort of a product of the times.
Well, a product of the time, but also, too, if I understand correctly, there was some concern that Prince wouldn't approve.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Certainly, like later as he became more religious and stuff like that.
Right. He was a Jehovah's Witness,
yes,
correct?
Yes, he was.
But like there's certain things. Like this, today has been one of these days where it's like nothing but Prince stories. And they're, a lot of them are apocryphal and you don't know if they're true or not. It almost don't matter. But I saw a great thing that was sent out by Michael Dwyer. This guy wrote a book on Prince for MTV. And he concludes a story about how Prince was – he calls him up. He's like, Tim Clawson is the producer, and he's telling him a story. Prince has an idea for a video. We meet him up the next day, and it's for Love Sexy. He's describing a scene where he'd be in bed with a girl. Beside a bed would be a neon sign that said Love Sexy. He said, we can do that at my house. I said, we'll build the sign on the set and have it transported over. And he said, we can do it at my house. And I thought, oh, I get it. You have a neon sign in your bedroom that says Love Sexy. Right. Like, it's not like, it's like, this is something that I have. Let's take advantage of it. And like that, he's such an unusual person and so much cooler than everyone.
Well, I mean, that he had such an interesting persona too, because there was so much duality about him. You know, I mean, a lot of his music, you know, there's that struggle sort of between sex and spirituality. There's a really ambiguous nature towards what made him tick, because he was so press shy and he did not do a lot of interviews. He was notorious for not letting people record interviews. He really didn't even like it if you took notes. And, you know, he was so outwardly flamboyant, but there, you know, on stage and stuff, you know, I mean, he would perform basically in the wardrobe that the Golden Girls used to wear. Which I remember watching, by the way, the Forum going, God damn, that looks comfortable. That looks
well, except
so
for the heels. Except for the heels.
Heels look tough. But every, you know, those like pajamas he was wearing. That,
but, like, but by the way, to be able to perform and play like that in those platforms was freaking amazing.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, like, there was so much. He was just interesting. And like, you know, sex was a constant theme in so much of his music. But like, what I also thought was really interesting is how much of that sex was also depicted in a way that made it clear that it was like about not judging. And like the lack of judgment and doing your own thing and being free, you know, free to live the life that you
free to be freaky. If you want.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had that song.
Perhaps even Freaky Deaky.
He had a song, Free. I mean, you know, be happy that you're free. You know, I mean, like when you're listening to my daughter, I was saying before, she's become a huge Prince fan. And, you know this. And I think anyone with kids know little kids like to hear the same song over and over and over. So there are certain songs she's gotten really into that I've had to basically play on a loop, and I don't mind because they're Prince. But one of them for a while was Little Red Corvette. And when you keep hearing that song on a loop over and over, A, you really recognize just how amazing Little Red Corvette is, like as a song.
Yeah, it is, actually, I found this is a live version of it. Keep talking.
It is like maybe the best written pop song I've ever heard. Like just as a perfect pop song. Like it's got.
Well, but how do you? You could say that about.
But I mean, but
probably 10 other songs.
Little Red Corvette in particular too, because it's like a fun, you know, metaphor for sex, and it's like a fun, clever play on words. There's so much imagery in the storytelling, the specificity of this one-night stand and the way he breaks it down. It's like a perfect length of a song. The melodies are amazing. It's accessible, but it's not shallow or bubblegum. But what I also think is amazing, and this was something that really started getting driven home to me as I was listening to it over and over, is the empathy and concern that he has for this woman that he's having the one-night stand with. You know, because at the end he's saying, like, you've got to slow down, you know, like the talking about, like, you know, going to ride your body to the ground, you know, the play on words, the body of the car, but also her body. But at the end, like that wail that he has, like that, you don't do that about someone you don't care about. Like it
I never
really,
thought about that.
It really started dawning on me as I was listening to this song over and over, and just like the treating of her as a person. As she's a one-night stand, like coming on to him, like really, you know, saying, we're going to do this. And then, like, you know, a song off like Sign of the Times, you know, I can never take the place of your man. Again, like the sympathy he has towards a woman.
That was, by the way, was not planned. I just happened to have it up there.
That he's just saying, like, I could never take the place of what you're trying to fill. I couldn't do it. And, you know, a one-night stand isn't going to do it either. And there's just, for somebody that is so attached with his reputation to sex and so synonymous with sex, there's so much humanity to Prince's songs.
President Obama was, you know, expressing it. Like I said, I don't know anybody who doesn't like some of his, maybe not everyone is devoted, but I don't understand how you can go through life, particularly as somebody of our generation.
Yeah.
Who grew up with this music, who was at an age where you could appreciate this sort of thing when Purple Rain came out. I mean, I in terms of signposting, I know which year of camp I was in when Around the World in a Day came out, because that's the tape that I listened to that summer.
1985.
That was the summer. I was 10 years old. That was the summer that I, you know, got it. Purple Rain was
1984.
The year earlier. And
want to know the rest of the 80s?
I think I got it. But it's like, and even as, like, he has sort of a period where, like, the stuff wasn't as good or a little drier or whatever, there's still these moments where, like, incredible songs would pop up.
Yeah.
You know, like, the Batman soundtrack, which is okay.
Oh, I think it's really good.
But it has, you know, like, Electric Chair is one of my favorite songs.
If you can find it on YouTube, because Prince is notorious for taking everything of his off YouTube.
Yes, it actually took a lot of work for me to find this stuff to put up here.
But if you can find him on SNL performing Electric Chair, it's amazing.
I mean, that is an incredible song.
But, you know, we were talking too, Brian, about the timelessness of Prince's music. And right now, the current song that my daughter has me playing on a loop over and over is When You Were Mine.
Oh, okay, I don't have it.
From Dirty Mind. And, you know, I've been hearing this song now over and over and over. And there's things you notice in the song. Like, it's got these, you know, beyond just, you know, sort of the funk and R&B that's, you know, present in all of Prince's music. There are these elements of, like, new wave synthesizers and, like, doo-wop and, like, you know, these bass slaps that could be James Brown or they could be Devo. And, like, you know, the song can be sweet at times, even though he's talking about a girl that, while they were together, was openly sleeping with other women. And just there's this.
Which, by the way, Lily is probably too young to pick up on.
Doesn't pick up on that. But openly sleeping with other men, other women. I mean, everybody, you know. And there's just this timelessness. Like, it's his music is, it feels like he owned the 80s, which he did, but his music doesn't feel handcuffed to the 80s.
No.
There's a timelessness to it. Because he took so much, his influences, he made them their own, but they were so present.
We were talking to Jeff Biggs before the thing. He was actually at that concert where the Prince was,
I think it was 81.
81, he said.
It was 81.
When he opened for the Stones, it was like they were throwing stuff at him. He was booed off the stage.
Might
in LA, right?
Mind. Yeah, oh, he was in LA.
And, he said one of the other bands that opened were, it was Prince, he said Jay Giles and George Thorogood.
Yeah.
Those two, like Jay Giles, who was a fun band. That was a Jay Giles band was fun. That is a very period band. They are tied to the 80s.
70s and 80s.
Right,
yeah.
but that era. Early 80s too. I mean, I guess so. It's late 70s, early 80s. But like, you're right. Prince doesn't have that because in part because the music is just it's transcendent in that way. Purple Rain is Abbey Road. It's, you know, Revolver. It's albums like this that are.
Eric Clapton has described it before as his desert island album. Like if he could only have one, he said before it's his favorite album. And like, I think Purple Rain is as good or better of a love song that I've ever heard in my life.
It's incredible. Yeah, it's, I agree. And I can't think of one that's better.
Well, he said, too, like Prince, it's been talked about that he wrote it intentionally trying to create these anthem songs. Like he said, like he saw the reaction at, of all people, Bob Seger. Like these concerts where, you know, like crowds would really, really start singing along to what he was saying. And it becomes like this movement. And he wanted to come up with like this communal reaction. And he wanted a song like that. So he intentionally wrote Purple Rain with that type of like uplift, like a slow build.
It worked.
By the way, too, if you've never seen this, I've tweeted it out at Cam Brothers. I'll look for it again. But you can see the Purple Rain that is on the soundtrack and in the movie, the performance, the first time Prince ever recorded that ends up on the soundtrack, was live.
And it was one take.
It was one take with the band in front of a crowd that had never heard it before. And you can find this, you know, hopefully it doesn't get taken down like everything else, you know, videos. It's amazing to watch because you're literally watching music history getting recorded before your eyes and nobody's aware of it. Nobody realizes they are part of what's going to become a seminal moment in pop music history.
Yeah, it wouldn't be for whatever, another year later or however long it takes for an album to come out. I mean, that's amazing. That's a cool story. I knew it was one take, but I didn't know that whole other part of
it. Yeah, they used, I mean, there's some overdubs and things like that, and they cleaned
but
it up.
Right, but it's basically one.
But that version is the Purple Rain.
It's like my favorite song is a song called Sweet Thing. It's on, it's Van Morrison's song on Astral Weeks. And that was an album that was recorded, the whole album was recorded in 2 days.
Yeah, something like that.
So like stuff like that happens in music, and you can kind of feel it. There's a certain energy and a rawness to it. Do you want to go out? I have two songs left. Do you want to go out on Mountains or Pop Life?
That is
hard to
tough.
Go wrong.
That is
with Mountains
tough.
Or Pop Life.
That is tough.
Lyrically, Pop Life kind of feels appropriate, but on the other hand, Mountains is awfully good too.
I would go Pop.
We'll go Pop
Life. I think it's a little more appropriate.
So,
off the Around the World Today album.
Right. It's a sad day, but you know, we want to talk about a guy who's leaving a legacy. Certainly, Prince qualifies, and we'll see everybody next time.